Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit UCTV.tv/stemcell.
I'm very excited here this afternoon to actually address one of my favorite questions that's coming up, and I get asked this a lot. So what is the difference between machine learning and artificial intelligence? I'm actually not going to answer this question directly today, but hopefully after my talk, every one of you will start to form some opinion about it. So we live in the golden age of machine learning, and it's very exciting to see how we continue making news, breaking boundaries. Vision being the first domain that I would argue we conquered it. Now machine learning has achieved supernatural abilities to track, identify, and essentially just follow any object that comes within our view of vision. And the next domain that we start conquering is in language. Now computer machine translations are capable of translating text across several hundred languages. We have machines capable of generating new content and also just generating live captions as I speak. My personal favorite, of course, is AlphaFold 2, which was announced last year. And not only did it essentially solve this grand challenging biology of predicting protein folding, it actually ushered in an exciting new age of machine learning aided drug and material discovery, which you can imagine will just accelerate all sorts of progress. So it's almost magical what we can achieve in machine learning. But I hate to say this, unfortunately, the magic here is very, very expensive for specialized hardware and data. Lots, lots, lots of data, as my colleague Sujith already pointed at. In fact, right now, we're in this trend of what we call the so-called large data, large model trend. As transformer models first gets popular in the early 2018s, you can see this trend show here in this graph. And the last example being recently this week announced the Megatron Turing model by Microsoft. This model have 500 billion parameters. Just let that sink in for a little bit. And also I want to draw your attention to this red line. Don't let it deceive you. It looks straight and linear. If you pay attention to the y-axis, you realize that it's exponential growth. If you think about the kind of resources goes in training one of these models, it's not achievable by just any entity. And if we continue this trend, we literally are going to run out of resources on Earth training these large models. And you know what? As we invest so heavily in all these machine learning models, not always well. It's not very hard to actually find examples where machine learning just fall flat short. So in this example that came out by Schiller and all in 2012, they proposed a set of synthetic visual reasoning tests. The test is very simple, and you can essentially break it into two categories of essentially procedurally generated images. You can think about the problems come in two types. One is sameness difference. So on the first image on the left side, you can see that the two shapes are actually the same shape. It's just translated. So this is the sameness class. The one below it, it will be a difference class. The two shapes are actually different invariant of transformation. The ones the next two on the first row is what we call spatial relationship. The smaller image is inside the large shape. And then the one next to it, it's also a spatial relationship. line in the straight line. As it turned out, the machine learning models that can perform perfectly identify spatial relationships performs rather poorly at some problems, even at chance, identifying sameness and a difference type of problems. So let this sink in for a little bit. Sameness and difference, this is really basic intrinsic concept. It's not new. It's not like a concept that only human can grasp. In fact, even honeybee can. So in this behavioral study done by Weber and Oh in 2013, they actually tested the honeybee on this thing called delayed matching on sameness. They use a Y-shaped maze that has three gates. The honeybee would enter the maze through the stem of the Y on one gate and have to choose to exit the maze on the arm of the Y. Specifically, these gates are either coded by color or shapes. And in this case, they first train the honeybees to follow, to enter the maze with, say, yellow color gate, and then choose to leave the maze with another yellow color gate that would lead to food. So thus, matching on sameness. After they successfully train the honeybees to do that, they switch the gate to actually striations or patterns. The same honeybee can be trained with very few examples. Again, grasp on the sameness idea of following, for example, two horizontal striped gates to lead to food. So honeybee can do this. Machine learning, not so great. Well, what can we do? Since the inception of machine learning, we always take inspiration from biology, and the perceptron is, after all, modeled based on biological neurons. So to that extent, our group actually collaborated with Gabe's group in trying to understand how dynamics and layout or geometry really influences a network's ability to learn and the capacity to learn. So to this extent, we implemented some realistic dynamics, for example, inhibition and excitatory neurons, activation threshold, weight decay, refractory period, internal propagation delays, and the spike timing dependent plasticity. As far as the network architecture goes, we have an array of ranging from random like error string, stochastic block model to regular click grid lattice to some biological inspired layouts like connectomes of C. elegans and morphological lattice. Our results are both promising and puzzling. Promising in the, I'm going to show you the first video is what I categorize as promising. In this video, we use a random initialized network, and the stimulus we use are MNIST digits, which are 28 by 28 black and white digitized handwritten like digits. We sent the stimulus through this network, and then we took the activation path embedded using a method called pass to vec, and then we PCA down to three dimensions just for visualization. Here you can see that the activation path actually corresponds with the stimulus classes very nicely. In fact, that when we visualize it, you can see this dark brown dark brown patch on the top that corresponds to class one, and then this for example purple patch here corresponds to class two, I believe. However, what we mostly run into is actually this second scenario where we just randomly stimulate 20% of the nodes. And you will see both blue and orange edges. Blue are excitatory, orange are inhibitory. As you can see, as the simulation just goes through a couple iterations, soon it gets to the state that the network is saturated, it's very chaotic, and we don't actually know how to analyze this. It's almost akin to giving someone seizure. And as we explore more and more of this neurodynamic inspired model, what we realize is that the search parameter space is really large and it's not linear, which means that we can't just hand tune one parameter and expect everything to work. We really need somehow a way to guide us to find how to tune and even initialize these things. And that's where Ellison and his wonderful organoid came into place. I don't have to tell anyone in this panel about how wonderful these organoids are, not only because after a certain level of development, they start to manifest these population-wide synchronicity behavior, but this is really the first time we have a miniature brain model that we can observe how it grows. We can study, we can actually start measuring its internal activities. So to this extent, Francesca in Ellison's lab started pioneering this technique about constructing an effective network based on activities measured at different sensor locations in multi-electric array, and using this correlation and the delays to build a graph. And what we end up doing is constructing a time series of a graph based on these activities. So what you see here on the right side, some examples of these graph, they actually represent a snapshot of growth in this organoid development period. What is really awesome about these graph sets, it's actually a domain that us computer scientists understand and can study. And also what's also fascinating about these graph sets, it might not necessarily represent the physical connectome, but in the effectiveness, it's a way for us to start understanding representations or embeddings, how they manifest. And just a word about embeddings or representations. Here, I actually showed six different representations of the same underlying graph structure. In this case, is a Bing user search graph, specifically in electronic devices. And we actually even color-coded the type of the device that the Bing user is searching. The data is the same, and as you can see that, the representation is completely different. And with these different types of representation, they actually have a different purpose. In the case of a Bing user a search graph, we use combining multiple of these representations, actually using a method called linear integer programming to help us better understand what the user search for and respond with search queries. But not just useful actually in Bing or web search. In the bottom example, we actually have a connectome that's constructed by our collaborators in Cambridge of Drosophila larvae. This is a very detailed connectome that it's not just mapping out how the cells or neurons are connected, but it goes to subcellular. It maps out parts of the neurons that's connecting. So you can see connections of axon to dendrite or dendrite to dendrite likewise. With that subneuronal level connections, we're able to construct four different representations or four different graphs. And when we started trying to figure out how or which representations are better, that's when we could tie to what we need to do. And in the case of we're trying to find all the mushroom body input of motor neurons, we actually find that by combining all these representations, that's what gives us the best results. So I talked about where machine learning fell short and how we take inspiration from biology and organoids, for example, are really helpful for us to understand the computer and the development changes and its effect on abilities to learn. And now I'm going to circle back to this thing that I originally started with, machine learning and artificial intelligence. So I don't think I'm qualified to define intelligence, artificial or otherwise, But what my colleague like Sujit and among others and I have come up with is a list of desirable traits, what we would like our AI to be able to do. And as Sujit already talked about, foremost, we'd like to be efficient. Biological organism has to function in very limited, resource-limited situation. So should our AI. And then it also has to have the ability to generalize. If I learn to identify cats inside my house, I better be able to identify cats outside my house. Otherwise, that skill is very limited. And if I understand about sameness difference by being able to visually tell two subjects apart, I should be able to understand the same concept of sameness difference when it comes to auditory, tactile, or olfactory. Then, you know, like some higher cognitive abilities, reasonings, something that I never encountered, I should be able to say that I don't know, which is also very basic. Then relationships of things that's larger or smaller or even causal. If I drop a pen, it will fall. Last but not least, if we want our AI to help improve our life and help us guide us make decisions, we better understand why it's making those type of suggestions. And that's why it has to be explainable. So how do we achieve all that? And I hope by now I have convinced everyone that it's not about building the most expensive cluster, gathering the largest data set, and train the biggest model. What I believe is that we have to do this side by side with biology by actually designing a set of experiments that can be run all the way from organoids to fly to zebrafish and human. And these set of tests have to be invariant to language and also knowledge bias. The purpose for this set of tests is to quantify how biological capabilities along the five axes that I talked about. But more importantly, it's actually for us to observe this learning process, but also pragmatically using a measurement to quantify learning and the progress, as Sujit already alluded to, for example, using information bottleneck. Only when we can understand how learning occurs and quantify these things, we can really start taking inspirations from natural intelligence, from biological organisms to improve our AI. So this is what we propose as a collective alternate approach to solving the intelligence problem.